Hello and welcome to our replacement show for Tour Live this week. Neil Atkinson here. Sort of felt, obviously, in the run-up to the World Cup, wasn't expecting there to be a ton of news. And even with the takeover sort of bubbling away, there's not really anything much to report. So we've worked instead on pulling a few little bits and pieces together around books in the run-up to Christmas. You know, everyone's wondering about what to get for presents, what they may or may not like, and so on and so forth. So the first thing that we've got coming up here is Pep Linders talking about his book Intensity, which is obviously fantastic, you know, and it's great that he did it. We're going to have a further chat, a longer chat on coaching with Pep next week. Also coming up after Pep, we've got John Williams, who's updated his book and ended up with Red Men Reborn. There'll also be a longer chat with John in the near future as well about all of that. If I'm being absolutely honest with you, we actually had the chat, John and I, earlier today, if you want me to pull back the fourth wall, but I'd not pressed record on the Zoom. So we chatted away for 35 minutes. It was fabulous. I can't wait to do it again. I might take it in a slightly different direction to start with the next time. But genuinely, no matter how many years you've been doing this sort of thing for, it is astonishing how often you can fall at the most straightforward and basic of hurdles. John took it all in wonderful spirit, as you would expect, and is hopefully looking forward to speaking to me again. But in the meantime, we definitely got this bit, and you'll be able to hear it right now. And I shall go back to whatever it counts for as school on these matters. Next up as well, we've got John Elledge, old friend of the show, always good to speak to him, and it doesn't have to be about football all the time. The books that you may or may not want to buy for yourselves or for others, he's co-written his with Tom Phillips. It's called Conspiracy, and we had a lovely chat in a London pub. I do very much enjoy going down to see people and sitting in front of them with a pint and having a conversation about their book. There should be some sort of way I can do that full time, to be quite honest with you, but you know, one step at a time. It'd be like start the week on Radio 4, but with more pints, but just as much reading and quality, and John shows that as well. And the last little thing is Halcyon Publishing have pulled together one of their special sort of anthology editions where they get a number of different writers. I did one about sort of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory for them a couple of years ago, which I really enjoyed doing, and they didn't ask me back for this one, which is called Against All Odds. It's the greatest World Cup upset. Maybe they thought that I wasn't able to write about things that, you know, aren't directly pertaining to Liverpool. Who's to say, you know? But my nose hasn't been put out a joint or anything like that. Maybe they just think I'm rubbish, which is also allowed and possible. Someone who isn't rubbish is Andy Thomas. Somewhat rave about Andy's extended essay, embarrassingly, to be honest with you, at the start of this, what passes for an interview and isn't just me gushing about it. It's a phenomenally good piece of writing. I've been thinking about it ever since. So, yeah, play it cool. Ultimately, this entire segment has basically made clear to you just how much of a quite the nerd and geek I am, to be honest with you. But regardless, you're listening, so, you know, joke's on you. Anyway, let's get over and let's start with Pep. As ever, it's a pleasure to do this sort of stuff. Do consider buying any, if not all, of these books for Christmas. If we were better organised, we'd probably have some sort of facility through which we could sell them. But as I can barely manage to press record on a Zoom more than 75% of the time, you know, you've got to cut your losses somewhere. Here's Pep anyway. It's Neil Atkinson with Pep Linders. The book is called Intensity, Inside Liverpool FC, Our Identity. It's your identity, isn't it? You love it.
Yeah.
Love the intensity.
Nah, I love our team. So that's the most important. And I love the fact that what we are doing, a lot of things what people don't know is written down. A lot of stories which you would never know. And that's what I like the most. And if you want to know something more about us, why we are us, the mentality of this team, the mentality of this club, the things what happened in the past and what makes us now. And if you read it, you will understand how we go to difficult periods. So, it's a one in a lifetime for sure.
When you started it with James, who's present in the room, by the way,
yeah,
Were you thinking of it as a one in a lifetime? Were you thinking of it? You did hint towards it a couple of times in the book that you felt something was special. Something special, yeah, was happening in late July. Mm. You thought there's going to be a. You felt there was, the two of you, yeah, felt there's going to be a story here. Is that fair?
Yeah, especially because the COVID situation brought us like 4 weeks together in the preseason. So we had like our players for day and night, 4 weeks, 4 weeks in Austria. We could really organize a pre-season like never before. With this and the situation we were in the year before, by just getting like the Champions League qualification, that makes it so special that in the end we reach the Champions League. But we felt, yeah. And the most important thing is that we felt that we had to prove a point. And I felt from the first minute, from these first weeks, that our players, the staff, everybody had this feeling that... And what's cool about the book is that nothing has changed. So everything is written like... So if you read something stupid, what happened after, it was not... It's like that. But if you read something, what happened after, it was really how we felt. So, and if you see these, the process, how it influenced like the later stages of the season, now we say, I was thinking call it finals instead of intensity. But... you know, there's a lot, a big commercial department and Rich Sports and blah, blah, blah. But I like intensity because, why? I will tell you, because I hope in 5 years' time, people can read back. And that's for me, important. That's not a book. It's a book about that season. But the book hopefully is much more that people in 5 or 10 years, if you want to know the Jurgen Klopp era, and hopefully it's 10 years, what I'm trying to say is that they can read how it how things went.
You all the way through, you describe everything as finals. It was really interesting to me that you describe everything as finals, because I used to write and call them hurdles, that every single one of them needs to be cleared. Because that's you coach in a unique era, I think, because never before, maybe 2005 Chelsea, but apart from that, never before has there been the need for 38 finals. For me, the most astonishing thing about 2019-20 is to win 26 out of the first 27 games. And everyone does the cliche of, we're going to treat every game like a cup final. But you do. That's what you did then. And that's what, in this season, that's what you were doing. You were trying to treat every game like a final.
Yeah, and I hope the people read the mentality, how you create that on the training pitch, in the dressing room, in the meetings. And that's what, you see the face of Jürgen, you see the character. You see my face, my thoughts. For a whole year, I wrote down my thoughts. I have so much spare time now, by the way. It's unbelievable. I don't know what to do. So I analyze the opposition too much, probably. But not a fan, for a guy who loves the game, it's a must read.
I think it's a must read. For that basis, I think anyone should be buying it for Christmas, for anyone they know who loves Liverpool, but also, as you say, loves the game. Because to me, what's fascinating is, at times, you will only write a paragraph on the game in a week, and you'll write, you know, another 1,500 words about everything else that week. That's the bit that grabs you. We've all watched the game.
Yeah, exactly.
You've seen the game. Yeah. You don't need that. I'll tell you about this.
Yeah, cool.
That's your week, though, isn't it? And that's the point. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's the bit that, for you, the game is just, that's the bit that we get to see. So, the rest of it's yours.
So when I was working at PSV Eindhoven, it was where I started my career. I went in the summer and the winter to America, to United States, and I did. We had a collaboration with 5 clubs in California. We give presentations, demonstrations, blah blah. And there I start reading a lot of John Wooden. I mentioned him a lot of times.
We're going to talk about John Wooden.
Good. So, very important, because he's one of the guys who had the most influence on me without him knowing. But anyway, so I went to a library. I went through the sports section, how I always do when I go to a library. I sit there, take one book I like, and I pick one book, and I didn't know the guy. I didn't know. And I read one of his quotes, and the one what makes what I try to live each day is that, it says, make each day a masterpiece. And I tried with writing the book to make each day what I wrote a masterpiece. And I really tried to write for the fans. Like, you have to know this. This is too good, because Jürgen is saying this. If we don't tell you guys, you will never know. Because you forget. I think, and that's about the book. So I don't do a lot of things in my life, but the things I do, so I'm assistant coach, that's my life. I'm a husband and a father, and that's the other thing.
And you watch Netflix?
No, I don't. Yeah, yeah.
Chestnut Man?
Yeah, Chestnut Man. insane. But that's true. Yeah, and I watch Netflix, yeah.
That's allowed. It's allowed to watch Netflix. Netflix is in the book. Lasso is in the book. We're going to talk about that separately as well. John Wooden's in the book. Jürgen Klopp is very in the book, but it's Pep Linders' book. It's called Intensity. It's Inside Liverpool FC. It is make every book a masterpiece. It is an absolute pleasure to read. Anyone who loves Liverpool, but as I think, as Pep said, anyone who loves football should be absolutely all over this. Every single page, every little bit of it's absolutely fascinating. So much about personalities. Go on.
You know what? The only problem is with make each day your masterpiece.
Yeah.
Is that you always live in the present. You always live towards the next, the next, the next, the next, and you don't look back. So the moment the book came out, I don't give a shit. It's done.
It's done?
It's the past. Everybody who says, how do you feel with the book? Honestly, nothing.
It's done?
It's done. It's the next game that counts.
Excellent. Well, we're going to talk for the next thing of this, if you subscribe to the Anfield Wrap, about making each day a masterpiece. We're going to talk about Wooden. We're going to go through all of this. But in the meantime, you should buy the book. You should read the book. It is a perfect Christmas present. I'll say it again. Pep Linders intensity. It does the business. Neil Atkinson here, joined by Red Men, reborn author John Williams, A Social History of Liverpool Football Club, from John Holding, now to Jurgen Klopp. And John, you first released an edition of this book in 2010. You've hung on until 2022, I'd say. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like you didn't have stuff to update it with before this point. Why did you think 12 years was long enough, first and foremost?
Well, come on, I needed a bit more than a couple of years to update that book. That first book, to be honest, began solely as a book about the years at Liverpool before Bill Shankly.
Yeah.
And I was only pressed by the publisher right at the very end to say, oh, come on, you've got to write the entire history up to where we are now. And I wasn't really in favour of that, to be honest. I wanted people to learn about Liverpool before Shankly arrived. Too many people thought the story begins with Shankly. And so, you know, we're in lockdown. Amazing things are happening. Klopp is here, who for me personify Shankly. I mean, it's extraordinary how his approach, for me, so resembles what Shankly tried to do back in the 60s and early 70s. And I couldn't resist. I sat down and started writing when we were all at home with nothing much else to do, and finally produced Red Men Reborn.
The key, I mean, there's lots of key aspects to Red Men Reborn, and we'll have a conversation for subscribers next week, slightly longer. But one of the things I want to talk about there, but we can touch on here as well, is what I'm fascinated by, and why I do think it is interesting you've hung on sort of 12 years, is because the key thing that happens as and when the original book comes out is there is then the takeover from Fenway Sports Group. And it's mildly ironic there may now be the sale from Fenway Sports Group at the same sort of time as you releasing this next one. But it seems to me is that that's why I thought, you know, so much is packed in to those sort of first 8 years, let's say hypothetically, the run through to the key final. Under Fenway Sports Group, both, you know, in terms of social history, in terms of both the way in which Liverpool operates, the way in which football itself operates and changes, and the way in which the Liverpool supporter base post the Hicks and Gillette protests becomes something quite different as well. And, you know, there is so much just in those 8 years that, you know, you get a couple of chapters, but you could get even more than that just out of that run.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I could have written a completely different book. I could have taken out all of the stuff on Shankly, Paisley and the other guys, Houllier and Benitez. And you're right, just focused on that moment and what happened afterwards when the Americans came in, because that's really where Red Men ends, at that very point when the new owners are making a complete mess and people are starting to protest, and we can see where the game is heading. And I could have done that, I guess. A lot did happen, but I wanted, or I felt I wanted to see what the outcome of all of this was, to give me a bit of time. I'd only just published Red Men, to be honest, and I that's a pretty exhausting exercise in itself.
Absolutely.
And so I wanted to see what happened. We came out of that on the other side, amazingly. We got this extraordinary new manager, Klopp. And things seemed to restart, and I thought that was the point at which I needed to come back and update some of those chapters, you know, add some material to Shankly, Paisley and those other guys, because I'd really squeezed those in at the end of Red Men. So I wanted to update that material and, of course, capture some of the extraordinary things that have happened since.
The I think it needs. I think it's an excellent book, by the way, if I haven't already said that. And I think it needs the, firstly, it needs the period prior to Shankly in, and then it needs the Shankly period in, because there's always this tension at the heart of any Liverpool project between tradition and the future. And within that as well lies success. So, you know, you frame Shankly brilliantly as this figure who bemoans in lots of ways what can be referred to during his time as modern practices, in inverted commas. And yet simultaneously, Liverpool are undertaking tons and tons of modern practices. What they're not doing is sort of pretentiously detailing them as modern practices. Paisley, as you detail in the book, as a physiotherapist, as someone who had observed, went into hospitals to observe the way in which, you know, the physiology of humans, which a lot of football trainers hadn't done in that period. You know, stuff like that's always this really interesting tension at the heart of the Liverpool project. And that goes right the way back to 1892. And you detail that repeatedly within the history brilliantly.
Yeah, I think that's true about Shankly. I think Shankly is a really complex character, because you're right, he symbolizes modernity when he arrives at Liverpool. And I've said elsewhere that Ian St. John particularly was a major part of that. You know, this synthesis of youth culture, pop music, culture around the game, fan involvement. Shankly coming in and telling the Kop again that it was important, you know, something that they hadn't been told really since the 1930s. But Shankly does symbolize modernity and at the same time be completely resistant to some of the mad ideas at the FA and others who want to over-technologize the game and reduce it to some kind of almost computerized algorithm. He's completely opposed to that kind of stuff. But he is a very modern voice, I think, and transforms the club. They've been through this miserable 1950s, you know, with a really kind of inert board who are simply unwilling to spend any kind of money at all. And then Tom Williams comes in, takes over the chairmanship and has a bit of vision and hires Shankly and gives him some freedom. I don't think many people realised that Shankly was the first Liverpool manager to pick his own team. You know, up until that point, the board pretty much picked the team and the manager sort of trained and prepared the players. Of course, when Shankly comes in, he's not having any of that. He's going to pick the team. He's going to get them to buy. They bring in some transfers. He's going to modernize the club and we're off. And we're off into a wonderful period under Shankly. Although, again, lots of people don't realize that Shankly went six seasons without winning anything. You know, you can't go six games these days without people asking questions about, you know, what's going to happen and are you going to stay. It's extraordinary.
Within this, again, I'll pull it back again, and the reason why I would recommend this book to any Liverpool supporter, and especially anyone who's found the team, and I think, you know, people can find Liverpool at any point in their lives. You know, I think I'm always in favour of that. It makes your life better and embrace it. You know, to go all the way back to the... not the very start of the club, but for instance, the start of the club as a genuinely successful entity. It's striking to me again that there's, in amongst the Tom Watson sort of era, with this complex scouting network he ends up with that's widely acknowledged within the game, that he ends up with a remarkably futuristic footballer, arguably, not understandably so, given the fact that there's, you know, no video footage of him, but someone like Alex Raisbeck, who changes his position, changes the way in which it's interpreted. Again, Liverpool have this sort of hook into the past, but simultaneously there is something that's always very forward-looking, and that goes all the way back to the 1901 team.
Yeah, you're right. Raisbeck is, I think, a revolutionary player. I mean, he's the Steven Gerrard and more of his generation. But even, you know, if you look a little bit forward into the 2022-23 team, and Tommy Bromelow, who plays in the middle of that team, he also is an incredibly sophisticated footballer for his time. What I liked about the early period was finding out about the way the crowd articulated aspects of the culture of the club and the place of the game in the city. Because even very early on, you know, even before the First World War, there are examples of people writing songs and sending them in to the Echo. There are examples of Liverpool beating opposition too comfortably, too easily at home. And so the crowd playfully start to support the opposing team. Now, you know, we think these are incredibly kind of modern post-war practices, but they were going on at Liverpool very early on. And you know, there's a sense in which that the game articulates lots of those different influences that the city has, the oral traditions of the Irish, the input of the Scots and the Welsh, and of course those American influences, which are so modernising and important for Liverpool.
It's excellent, it really is. It's very much worth reading. Red Men Reborn by John Williams. It is almost encyclopedic in terms of the way in which it frames Liverpool's story. Starts in 2021, 2022, and then loops all the way back to 1892, and then brings us forward to the present day. Mile point of order, John. Just at the foot of page 379 before we play Watford in the 2019-20 season. You said the learned folks at the Anfield Rap podcast were predicting a 3 or 4 goal Liverpool win before that game against Watford, which was seen both obtuse and asking for trouble. John, I was on holiday at the period. So otherwise things could have been very different indeed. It's been a pleasure to speak to John. We'll talk to him more next week if you are a subscriber to the Anfield Rap about many of the themes that come out in the book, but do most definitely go and pick up a copy of it from wherever you get your books from. It's been a pleasure, John. We will speak to you very soon.
Thanks, Neil.
Beer 52, then Neil Atkinson here. How does a case of delicious beer sound this festive season? There is the World Cup, and we all know about that, but there is very much Christmas as well. And Christmas is indeed what this sort of thing's about. It's when I get stuck into the Beer 52, to be quite honest with you. So you can get a free case of 8 craft beers if you go to www.beer52.com/wrap, W-R-A-P. And you cover the postage cost of $5.95, you will get your free case. I am indeed a member of Beer 52. Comes from all over the world. John, I've genuinely been saving them up for a couple of months off the back of it's good to have this sort of stuff in stock around Christmas.
Yeah, I find it winter drinks as well, craft beers, do you know what I mean? Like, they're fine in the summer and stuff like that, but winter, I feel like they come into their
picks
own.
Up.
Yeah, they really come into their own. It's exactly what you want. Isn't it? And yeah, I'm sure the good people of Beer 52 are tailoring just for that. Great spelling out, by the way. I'm dreadful at that bit.
Oh yeah,
I get myself in a right mess.
The 5-2.
Yeah. And can't spell rap, considering, you know. I mean, it's four letters and B is the name of our business.
And three, it's all around you. It's all around you. Do you know what I mean?
Honestly, just saying letters. I struggle with
like
that
a fella at the opticians, guessing.
Yeah.
Have you used to wear glasses? Do you?
No.
What are the most sort of embarrassing moments at the opticians at the moment where you realise the optician has worked out that you're guessing at that point? Can you read the bottom row for us? C? could be an O.
Are they Greek letters now? Yeah. Is this a trick?
Yeah. And he's like, he or she is like, well, that's that then. let's be crystal clear. So honestly, from right the way around the globe, it is independent breweries from across the globe, and that is one of the things that I like it about it a great deal. This year so far, beers have been experienced from 40 countries, spanning 5 continents, and you can try the best from across the world with the UK's number one beer club. If the dark beer isn't your thing, you can choose the light only option. But it's winter, as John says, as ever there's a time to get stuck into the dark beer.
At least give it a go. That's the whole beauty, is you giving things a go. If you don't enjoy it, then just move on. Move on to the next one.
Exactly that. And also, if it's only the cost of the postage as well, there's nothing really lost there in amongst all of that. You get the award-winning Ferment magazine.
Have you clocked its award-winning now?
Yes, it's been a change of pace. I want to know what the awards were. It's like Gutman's gutter.
Yeah. I think theirs are probably more genuine than Rob's.
Well, you'd like to think so. And also, this is an advert, so I shouldn't insinuate the opposite, to be honest with you. But I'm sure they'll be fine about it. The Ferment magazine won the awards, and you get the couple of tasty snacks. And if you're unsatisfied after all that, you can pause or cancel at any time. So it's www.beer52.com/WRAP to claim your free case right now. Beer52.com/WRAP in there as well. It is the absolute business if you get the opportunity to do so. It is absolutely for everyone. That is one of the key things, and I think that stuff matters massively. Everyone likes a drink.
Yeah.
It's amazing that, isn't it? That, you know, it's not just either one gender or one type of person. Everyone likes a drink.
Unite us all.
Yeah, indeed. Enjoy it over the course of Christmas. It's a pleasure to be involved with Beer 52. They do deliver a really, really good product. It literally comes to my house. So there's no falsehoods there. It comes to my house, and currently it sits in the garage, and it will all be gone by January the 2nd. I can promise you that one. joined by John Elledge, always good to speak to, co-author of Conspiracy, A History of Bollocks Theories and How Not to Fall for Them. I wanted to get Tom Phillips, he wasn't available, so I'm left with you.
Yeah, well, thank you for mentioning him, though. Like, often, the thing about co-writing a book is, like, often people would just slip in to say, you've written this book, and I have to, like, try and crowbar his name in, or vice versa, because otherwise you feel terribly guilty.
My first question was going to be, how was it writing a book with someone else?
It was lovely. I've done it.
Yeah.
It was actually lovely, because, like, everyone, like, I've known Tom for 20 years, we're at university together, we've not worked together before. And we just happened to have the same agent and be working with the same publishing group. And like all our mutual friends were like, oh, you're going to fall out. Everyone always falls out. If someone gets precious, you're going to hate each other. But it's sort of the exact opposite has happened. And I've come out of a really nice new friend and we're talking about doing another book together. We were talking about it this morning, what we might do next.
So you were at this school together, a university together.
You were at university, yeah.
And you've got the same publisher and you've got the same agent. Is this a grand sort of conspiracy? Are you them? Are you them who is stopping us from being able to flower? Is that what you're all about?
I am a lizard.
Are you the elite?
As you can probably tell from the slightly greenish tinge to my skin, and the fact I've laid 4 eggs since we've been sitting here, I am in fact an alien lizard secretly running the world. No, I mean, it's like, if you really want to be cynical about this, the publishers really wanted Tom's next book. Tom was a bit tired. I was offering to write. I was looking for another book.
So my conspiracy theory is lovely, defeated by the Monday.
Basically, our lovely agent, Anthony Topping. Oh, I can still get my 15% if I put these two guys together. So he's really the one pulling the strings here.
There is what I liked about the book. What I like about the book a great deal is. There have been bits and pieces, not tons, and you do point that out, but there's been writing about conspiracy theories is often very much, very sneery about the notion of the conspiracy theory. Whereas what you do quite early on within the book is, and repeatedly, is make the point that one of the reasons why conspiracy theories are successful in the way in which they spread for people is because there are some conspiracy theories that actually prove themselves to be true.
Yeah.
I'm always in these conversations reminded of David Cameron at one point described people searching for the truth around Hillsborough as searching for a black cat in a dark room when the blinds were drawn or something like that. That was never there. And people can convince themselves at times that certain things are conspiracy theories when I think it's important to say some of the things that can be portrayed by people as conspiracy theories actually indeed turn out to be fact, because that's an important part of being able to talk about them in totality.
Yeah, so I'm embarrassed to say I haven't followed the ins and outs of the Hillsborough story as much as I know you have, and this podcast has covered it very closely. But my read of that sight unseen would be that Cameron was not necessarily a sort of, you know, shadowy, powerful figure trying to cover things up. No. I think it's more likely he just didn't care enough to look.
He was just making assumptions about how he'd been told.
Yeah. But yeah, I think one of the points we come back to, two points we come back to again and again in the book, one of which is, as you say, there are real conspiracies. They do happen. At the most basic level, World War I happens because of a conspiracy to shoot a politician.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of the Black Hand Gang, a bunch of freedom fighters and or terrorists, depending on whose side you're on, who shoot Archduke Franz Ferdinand, which happens due to a cock-up because his driver turns the wrong way, and that leads to World War One. So you know, these things do happen. Another bit in the book, actually, in the celebrities chapter, I had this idea. I wanted to sort of end it on talking about the Britney Spears story and the idea she was being held prisoner by this kind of legal mechanism called a conservatorship, which is basically there to take power of attorney from older people who are losing their faculties. And they'd applied it to a woman in her late 20s who was having a bit of a stress-related breakdown. And because it's only for old people, there's no off-ramp. So suddenly there's this entire industry there to kind of limit her freedom of action and control over her own movements, because she makes a lot of money for people. And this was, you know, this came out when the theory went round that an Instagram post on her Instagram was not actually her, because it used an emoticon instead of an emoji.
Yep.
Because the language sounded slightly off. And in the sort of Britney fandom, there were like days of like, oh my God, I think someone's impersonating Britney. Because of these secret symbols, basically. And then And then this podcast called Britney's Gram gets a message from someone who claims to be a paralegal working on the case. He says, yeah, you're bang on, but they can't name him. This is all classic conspiracy theory tropes, right?
Yep.
So I wanted to end this chapter by telling this story, then getting to the end of it and swivel and pivoting and going, but here's the twist. We actually believe this one. We think this is really happening. And then I was undermined slightly by the fact that it came out that it was in fact true. And she was being held prisoner.
Was it all true?
Yeah, it was all true. But in form, it looks exactly like another, like a bunch of other insane conspiracy theories where the authorities are saying, no, nothing's going on here. But there's people going, no, I can read the runes. And that was true. I'm really going on. Sorry about this. As you can tell, I have a lot of thoughts. The other thing we keep coming back to in the book is the fact that just, you know, psychologically, we are all capable of believing this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, if you look at the research on it, there are signs that almost anyone can fall for the right conspiracy theory. Like, there has never been a point since 1963 where fewer than half of Americans agreed that John F. Kennedy was assassinated by a conspiracy rather than one lone guy. And there is genuinely no reason to believe that. There is nothing in that story that requires anyone other than Lee Harvey Oswald to be involved. Yet more than half of Americans have always assumed there is. So I think, you know, we are all capable in the right circumstances of buying into a conspiracy theory.
In the book, you refer to what's called the generic conspiracist belief scale.
Which it turned out that I'm quite prone to it, and my co-writer Tom isn't.
Really? You don't specify which way Ram.
I was a bit miffed to find out that I was the irrational one.
there is within that, though, you're really clear what the different types of conspiracies are. That there's, you know, there's effectively event conspiracies, systemic conspiracies, and super conspiracies. Yeah. Super conspiracies basically pull everything in their
It's like, you know, that meme from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia of like the guy pointing to the board with all the
ropes. Yes.
Or that bit, the Simpsons with Milhouse and the blackboard. It's that. It's like everything is connected.
Yeah, that's the big one. The systemic conspiracies are the specific systems that work against people, and event conspiracies is the basic form, which is individual events make up conspiracies. You pull them through as you go. It was interesting when you say you are. So what is a conspiracy? When you did the test, what was a conspiracy that you believed that pushed you above average or anything like that?
It's not like it asks you about specific conspiracy theories. It's questions about how you see the world. And it was only slightly above average, I think. I hope. I mean, the only thing... But I did... The only thing I can think of that is kind of... It's not quite a conspiracy, but it's structured like conspiracy. There were rumours about 10 years ago that somebody, he's a scouser actually, a guy called Philip Morris, had been to Africa and found many, if not most, of the missing episodes of the TV science fiction series Doctor Who. And as it turned out, because, you know, there were just rumours spreading through fandom and as it turned out, he had found some. He'd found 9 episodes, which is the biggest haul they'd been in decades. It was a lot. But in retrospect, thinking back about watching how the rumours spread and fed on each other, so you get verification, you get a second source on something and you think it was verification, when no, it's the echo chamber. They've spoken to your first source, kind of. And looking back on the way I did spend several months of my life reading forums and so on to look for more information on that is, it wasn't a conspiracy, but you can see it's the exact same dynamic, right?
Yeah, you go through when you're sort of going through the psychology of it, I find it really interesting. You deal with, you know, there's dissonance, the need to know, the desire to feel special.
The one I like is that it can become, conspiracist beliefs can give you a social circle.
Yeah.
And it can be hard if you recant on a belief in, I don't know, flat earth or whatever it is, then you're not only going to sort of drift away from certain friends, they're going to denounce you, they're going to think you're the villain. And what I like about that is it does pose conspiracy belief systems as basically the exact same thing as the Liberal Democrats. because I've been told that one of the reasons people stay in the party is because they don't want to say goodbye to their friends. But yeah, there's all sorts of reasons, both why people get sucked into this stuff and why it's hard to give it up.
I found nostalgia, anxiety, and comfort, and I think the three of them are actually connected. To be really interesting in this, so you discuss the idea of, you know, the progressive left taking a bit of a beating and ending up blaming shadowy puppet master / Russians on nostalgia and anxiety. You cite something from the USSR. I think those, the extent to which nostalgia, anxiety and comfort, desire for comfort, are driving forces of our society. And that's what I really enjoyed about the book, because a lot of this, it is about conspiracy, conspiracy theories, but it's actually about what drives society. They drive society so much more than I think we give them credit to. The people, there is a nostalgia for something, there's an anxiety about what might happen next, and there's a want for there to be a return to comfort. Is, I think these are overriding driving forces.
Massively, yeah. I mean, I think, I mean, in terms of the comfort stuff, one of the things that's a recurring theme in the book and in conspiracy theories more generally is just the idea that shapeless forces, faceless forces rather, can ruin your life is terrifying. Like, you know, a few years ago, so far as we know, a gene mutated in a virus on a bat somewhere in a wet market in southern China, and that turned into a virus which ruined a lot of people's lives. It killed a lot of people, but also it forced the rest of us to spend months or years of our lives stuck indoors, and, you know, people lost businesses, friendships were not made, people's time at university or education was ruined. And the idea that happened because of a random mutation, that's terrifying. It's almost comforting to imagine that bad guys did it, because if there are bad guys, you can defeat them. Someone can defeat them, theoretically. And just the idea that, you know, slight changes in technology or gas prices have ruined your business and therefore your life, that's far harder to get your head around and far more frightening, I think.
Yeah. Well, on that, the bad guys did it thing, I think it is at the root of a lot of this. And a lot of it starts and ends in remarkably malign places. But the human bit, the bit which arguably will be in common, as you say, for the vast majority of people, is that I would like there to be an individual or a group of individuals who are to blame. I would like it to be those people, I'd like it to be them. And I think that is, you know, whether we like it or not, I think that is a driving human thing that's probably been present in humanity, you know, going back literally tens of thousands of years.
Yeah, one of the things we sort of scratch around, but we don't kind of make it a part of the core thesis, really, I think, is conspiracy theories are kind of, we put them where we used to have gods. If you kind of think about how, you know, polytheistic systems, sorry, it took me a moment to think of the word there. Polytheistic systems belief where, like, oh, it's raining because of the sky god. It's
God of the sea, actually.
Yeah, you blame...
Sorry.
It's a way of putting faces on those kind of forces that can have massive impact on your life, but you can't entirely understand them. And then, you know, we move to a monotheistic system, so there's, like, one god that does everything. But, you know, since the Enlightenment, fewer people, or at least fewer people like us, have credited many of these things to either one or many gods. So you sort of need to plug someone else into that. Although, like, we talk about how conspiracies, there have been conspiracy theories for all of human history, as far as we can tell. Like, the oldest we could find, I'm sure there are older, but the oldest we could find is the Roman general Germanicus, who fans of Robert Graves may recall as the elder brother of Claudius, in I, Claudius. Germanicus spreads a conspiracy theory about his own death because he takes a month to die. So he spreads a number of conspiracy theories about who it is who has killed him. And he might have had cancer or something. You know, Roman medicine wasn't all that great. But nonetheless, that is a conspiracy theory. He's going around saying, oh, the political system is trying to off me. They've always been there, but I think since the Age of Enlightenment, I think conspiracism has gone through the roof, and I think it's because we need something, someone to blame.
Last question before we plug the book well and truly is, I was intrigued by, and I was surprised I hadn't myself gone, and it will be the French Revolution, the idea that the Illuminati question stems back from the French Revolution. You mentioned the Enlightenment there, that's part of that, but the French Revolution is this, you know, in terms of events that genuinely do massively define, at the very least, Western, that includes sort of Western US history, you know, not just Western European history, but Western history is defined by the French.
It's the beginning of the modern political age. It's when politics starts.
And that's when the idea of two people turning to one another, as you did detail in the book, going at the day of when they hear about the storming of the Bastille, that'll be the Illuminati. Is the start of the Illuminati conspiracy theory. It's almost like, I'm almost annoyed with you, it's too narratively perfect.
But the So I'm going to have to get the details right. That's one of Tom's chapters. He's the Illuminati expert. But it's worth saying the Illuminati were real. They existed. They were a Bavarian book group. They were a bunch of... It was like a secret society because everything was a secret society. That was how you made things sound cool. It was like being in the right WhatsApp groups or something. But they were basically a bunch of like guys in southern Germany, like talking about literature, criticizing the political system, and they were like portrayed as they were a problem for the authorities because they, you know, they had slightly progressive ideas in a period, and in a Catholic region that didn't allow for them. But nonetheless, it was this Bavarian book group that lasted 5 or 10 years and then petered out due to infighting, as left-wing political groups have been doing ever since.
No way.
but like, they, you know, they existed, but they weren't important. And it's just, there is just this kind of history of people drawing on, you know, conspiracists drawing on earlier conspiracists and pointing to groups who are secretly in control. And, you know, often you'll be shocked to hear it's the Jews. The Jesuits come up quite a lot. But also it's sometimes the Illuminati. And it's just they've just been plugged into these theories for 2.5 centuries. And I can't help but think that the guys behind that would have been surprised to know that that was their legacy. Because they were, you know, they were rationalists.
So the book is excellent, Tom Phillips and John Ellidge. It is called Conspiracy, History of Bollocks Theories and How Not to Fall for Them. Though do remember, John is very clear, you will fall for some of them occasionally. It's about being able to pull yourself back.
We try to offend everyone equally, so I'm sure there's something in there where we will tell you personally that you're wrong, so look out for that bit.
Excellent stuff. Get it for Christmas, be told that you're wrong, go from there.
I'm joined by Andy Thomas to talk about Halcyon Publishing's Against All Odds. I contributed to something Halcyon did a couple of years ago, which was about snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. This one is about miraculous football matches within the World Cup. And I am joined by Andy Thomas to talk about his one. Before we get into that, I'll talk about who else is in here. There's Harry Pearson, Tim Vickery, Tobias Jones, Adam Bushby himself, David Winner, author of the excellent Brilliant Orange, which I will recommend to anybody at any time, the wonderful Raphael Honigstein, Simon Hart is in there as well. Paul Doyle, you get more than one slab of Paul Doyle. There's James Montague, there's Philippe Auclair. I've probably forgotten other people. I've read Andy's chapter. It is about the miracle of Bern, which is West Germany 3, Hungary 2. You may be thinking, West Germany winning a World Cup final, what on earth is miraculous or unlikely about that? We'll circle back around onto that, but it is amongst the best bits of writing I have ever read about the areas where sport touches nationalism / patriotism. It is a wonderful piece of work. It genuinely is. It was a delight to read it this morning on the way in. Firstly, Andy, I absolutely hate praising my friends, so you know I'm sickened to the core by this turn of events. But you entered into this, I think, with a very big idea about precisely how important this whole thing was, the miracle of Bern, to West Germany in 1954.
Yeah. Well, so I started off thinking about it by thinking about the nickname Miracle of Bern and what the implications are, of course, of calling a sporting event a miracle. Because there's a few of those around. Football's got a couple of miracles. There was the miracle on ice when USA won the Olympic hockey. There's a few more. And one of the things that struck me about when we talk about miracles, a lot of miracles are kind of like miracles of healing. So somebody gets better. Lazarus is no longer dead anymore. And so on. And so it struck me that a lot of what people talk about this game is doing is being a kind of a moment of healing after the war for Germany. This game specific, because you know, Germany were massive underdogs. German football was nothing like the professional kind of admired around the world organization that it is today. And you know, and Germany itself was, you know, this was 9 years after the end of the war. Germans were still returning home from prisoner of war camps or country. The economy was a mess. Germany was split in half. The whole, you know, Europe itself was a mess, and Germany was at the heart of that mess. And this win, along with the kind of the economic miracle of Germany, is often kind of identified as a crucial moment when West Germany set out on the route to becoming Germany as it is now, as it is, you know, the modern leader of the European coalition and all the rest of it. So it's kind of very much digging into kind of what does it mean for a country to be healed or to be created by a football match.
On this, it's worth, you know, a number of things to sort of frame why, firstly, why this is so important. And it really is one of the, you know, it's a hugely important game, but it's worth sort of in you know, to frame the time period. It's literally closer. The end of the war, the end of World War II, is closer to the kickoff of this game than it is to the year that Hitler comes to power. As an example, you know, this is, you know, when you're talking about sort of the denazification of Germany, a massive part of all of that happens here in this moment, that they reclaim themselves. And the other part of why this is so miraculous as a football match is that Hungary had absolutely walloped West Germany in the group stages. Hungary were widely accepted, and even after the final whistle of this game, they were still widely accepted as the best team in the world. You know, one game of football doesn't necessarily change that, but it does end up sort of sullying that Hungarian legend a little bit. But this game, what it does for West Germany, it does sort of grab that process of denazification of Germany and becomes something that they themselves, West Germany, hooks into for the decades to come.
Absolutely. It's kind of it's used as a kind of like, you know, here we are, we're re-emerging onto the world stage in a more, you know, in a more benign form. It's interesting to think about that, because it's been presented that way a lot of ways, and quite a few people have been quite cynical about that. The film The Miracle of Bern, I think that's the name of it, when it came out, was it 2003, I think?
Around that time, yeah.
Was met with, you know, on the one hand, rapturous reception throughout Germany. Gerhard Schroeder goes and he bursts into tears and he comes out and he says, yeah, this is a wonderful story of the birth of modern Germany, whatever. But also some German critics were saying, no, what's happened here is Germany is telling itself a story of it becoming okay, and, you know, taking the suffering of war upon itself. And so it's this interesting, contested kind of historical narrative there. And a lot of, when you start to look at the game itself in its historical moment, obviously when you think of it as this kind of healing miracle, that makes it a start point of something. But it was very much tangled up with the history of the country that came out of the war. So the allegations of drug use of the German team, those allegations centered around Pervitin, which was an amphetamine used by the German armies. And a few days after the game, a very high up official in the German FA is dismissed for giving what is frankly a sort of a Nazi-esque speech about the, you know, the manifest destiny of the German peoples and all the rest of it. And the German fans of the game burst out into the anthem after the final whistle, and they sing the controversial Deutschland, Deutschland über alles verse. And you know, coverage across Europe is cut at that moment by horrified broadcasters saying, no, hang on, you're not supposed to be singing that anymore. So it's this very, there's this sense that it's kind of an inflection point of history where something new is starting, but it's starting from all of this tangled stuff that was already there. And so, you know, the idea of the miracle is that it's this kind of ta-da, everything's better. And yet you kind of dig down into the muck of it, and it's all very much still a part of a process.
Within the, when you're pulling it apart towards the end, you pull it apart absolutely beautifully. Once you flit it and out of literally describing the action and then pushing back into the ramifications of the action, and then your own sort of analysis of the action and the discussion around patriotism, nationalism, literally what a state is. I very much enjoyed the line that countries don't just have borders, they have flavours. Also the line that, you know, within there as well, a nation is a story that everyone keeps telling one another. There is, you know, in amongst all of here, this is such a core bit of the flavour of Germany, both in that moment and, you know, you mentioned Schroeder's response to it, the way in which it then resonates going down so many years. It is the core of why this one matters, perhaps more. And as I say, there's a lot of games that are discussed, World Cup games that are discussed within this book, but it's very difficult to find one that in such an intensely sort of nationally political sense matters this much. For instance, I think there's writing about the USA versus England, but it really doesn't, you know, I think Harry Pearson writes about that. That really doesn't have a certain sort of type of ramification. There's maybe only going through the whole book, quite possibly sort of Algeria versus West Germany, or maybe Senegal versus France, that have anywhere near the same sort of geopolitical significance on this scale that this one has.
Yeah, and obviously partly the significance of the game is because it's been the centre of the national story for all the years afterwards. So it kind of goes in and out of fashion in German discussion of German identity. But yeah, there's those points when people say, yeah, this was when modern Germany was founded. It was brought out a lot. As I say, in 2003 was when that film came out, which is not quite a Disney film, but it's getting on that way. And it's kind of the way it tells the story about Germans after the war and what the football game did for them. And it could, you know, and that's obviously that's ahead of Germany hosting in 2006, which is the first major football tournament post unification, I think. And obviously that's one of the 2006 tournament was very led to a lot of interesting discussion about German nationalism, because all of a sudden there were German flags everywhere. There's a lot of interviews at the time done by various newspapers where they go to the streets of Germany, talk to people with flags, and these people say, yeah, I always thought it would be absolutely disgusting to walk down the street with a Germany flag, and yet here I am, and I'm having a great time, and I feel good about the world. Isn't that strange? And so there's this constant, the nation is a kind of a story it constantly tells itself, is kind of where I'm looking at this from, what a national myth is. And it seems to me that this is just as much a myth of kind of how Germany thinks of itself as, I don't know, pick any historical part of the British identity that you like, and founding of the NHS or whatever. It's not just that this thing happened, it's that this thing happened and was then picked up by other people and told back in this kind of enforcing mythological loop, and it becomes central to the idea of who you and all your neighbours are.
Within it, you're doing lots of clever bits and pieces around the right, and you break it into little segments there. I very much enjoy the crossed out sixth goal. I would obviously very much enjoy that sort of thing. It's tricksy, so therefore I'm in favour of it. There is also this notion of you sort of within the shed trying to answer these questions, really, and you know, in and of itself anyway, sort of trying to resolve the whole thing into a satisfactory, to quote you, what or why done it, because the other side of the miracle of Bern is the fact that Hungary don't win. And, you know, Hungary have their say in amongst this, and especially in what passes for the post-match analysis, because, and again, it's really difficult to sort of put this into context in 2022, looking all the way back to 1954, not least because of the two teams that are facing one another. But Hungary had beaten England 6-3, and 6-3, according to all accounts, flattered the English in that victory. They had dismembered West Germany earlier in the tournament. They had beaten Brazil. Hungary were just quite simply the best ones, and then it doesn't happen. And so much of the rest of the lives of these Hungarians, I mean, you know, to understand this as well in terms of the national myth, you know, there is a bar, there is the 6-3 bar in Budapest, where if you can go in and name all of the sides that beat England 6-3, they will give you a free drink. I know that because they gave me a free drink. But from a Hungarian point of view, there's lifetimes that are almost trying to spend trying to explain this, because they never win a World Cup. They never get to another World Cup final. They never get the crowning glory that it would have been in this era to have been not just acknowledged as the best team, but actually win the thing that means you are the best team.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I was reading Puskás's autobiography when I was researching this, and it's absolutely fascinating the way he writes about the way the game goes and why they lose, because he doesn't know. And he basically takes the point of view that it was absolutely impossible for Hungary to lose. They thrashed them earlier in the tournament. They were better than them. They hadn't lost a game of football for years. And then he offers up all these little explanations, lots of boring football explanations, lots of kind of, we got khaki, mud, all these little kind of what would be perfectly good reasons for anybody to lose an ordinary game of football. But in the context of this game, in the context of how good Hungary are,
that they go 2-0 up after 10 minutes, well, after 8 minutes as well. In this as well, they're 2-0 up after 8 minutes.
Absolutely, and they are, you know, it's all going to plan. Everything is in the right place. Not just at the start of the game, but 2-0 up. They were that good. They had everything there. And it doesn't make any sense to Puskás, and he was there, and he's still upset about the offside equaliser in the 90-odd minute. And ever since then, other people have tried to explain what happened, and there are lots and lots of really good explanations. But because it's become this kind of miracle, as I say in the piece, none of the explanations really work, because the point of a miracle is you can't explain it. Something inexplicable that's come into the world from outside normal rules. And so all the explanations kind of slide off the strangeness of the event.
All right, the book is available. It isn't just your bits. There are other people's bits as well. Have you read other people's bits?
Yeah, I've read a few of the bits.
Are they good?
Yeah. I recommend the entire book. The bit on the Senegal chapter was great. That was the last one I read. Harry Pearson, you should always read Harry Pearson writing anything, just as a general rule of life.
There we are, a general rule of life. I have only read Andy's bit. If the other bits are as good as Andy's bit, I'll be amazed, but let's just sort of say that they are, and therefore the book is must read. It was an absolute pleasure. It's always great to speak to Andy. He should write more, to be honest with him. We could talk to him more, but, you know, he's got children and other things going on these days, sadly. You've got a cop for that sort of thing. The book is Against All Odds. It is on Halcyon Publishing. It is available from all the places you may or may not choose to get books from. I strongly recommend that you do get it.